Good morning. My name is Kara Mizue. I'm a senior sociology anthropology major. Today I'm honored to present Dr. Ronald Takaki, professor of ethnic studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Dr. Ronald Takaki and I are actually both from Hawaii. I'm from Aiea and he's from Pololo. So as a Japanese American woman born and raised in Hawaii, his work has truly been a source of inspiration and pride for me. His book, Strangers from a Different Shore, A History of Asian Americans, opened my eyes to the history of my ancestors and to the histories of many others whose stories have too often been marginalized. The grandson of Japanese plantation laborers in Hawaii, Dr. Takaki is a nation's preeminent scholar of multicultural studies, widely regarded as the founding father of the discipline. Dr. Takaki was one of the first to build a curriculum based on America's racial and ethnic diversity. After receiving his PhD in American history from Berkeley in 1967, Dr. Takaki was hired by UCLA to teach that school's first Black history course. While there, he helped to found the UCLA Centers for African American, Asian American, Chicano, and Native American Studies. Since returning to Berkeley, Dr. Takaki has chaired the Ethnic Studies Department and was instrumental in the establishment of that school's American Cultures graduation requirement. He is also an advisor to the Ethnic Studies PhD program, the first of its kind in the country. As a scholar, Dr. Takaki seeks to write a more inclusive and hence more accurate history of different ethnic groups in America. In his words, the presentation of multicultural history leads not to the disuniting of America, but rather to the reuniting of America. Dr. Takaki is a prolific writer with several award-winning books, including the critically acclaimed Iron Cages, A Study of Race and Culture in 19th Century America, the Pulitzer Prize-nominated Strangers from a Different Shore, A History of Asian Americans, and A Different Mirror, A History of Multicultural America, which was chosen for an American Book Award and was hailed by Publishers Weekly as a brilliant revisionist history of America that is likely to become a classic in multicultural studies. The title of Dr. Takaki's presentation is America in a Different Mirror, Revisioning Our History. There will be a book signing with Dr. Takaki here at the front of the chapel immediately following the convocation. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Ronald Takaki to Carleton College. And because Dr. Takaki is our honored guest, I'd like to present him with a lei.
Oh, good morning. Hey, isn't this more than a good morning? Isn't this a great morning, huh? Why is it a great morning? Well, look outside. I brought the California weather with me to Minnesota, huh? Yes. Also, I arrived yesterday, and Andrew Williams met me at the airport and then took me to dinner. And at dinner, there were two faculty members, and I was delighted to discover that one of your faculty members is also from Hawaii, and in fact, she had been one of my undergraduate students at Berkeley. Imagine, huh? What a surprise that was, yes. But then, Kara, I do feel honored to have a student from Hawaii introduce me this morning. Now, like Kara, I was born in Hawaii, and as Kara pointed out, I grew up in Palolo Valley. Kara grew up in Aiea, on the other side of the island. And I can remember growing up in Palolo Valley and the diversity of our community. To the left of my family, we had a Portuguese family. To the right, we had a Japanese family. Behind us, we had two Chinese families. Up the hill, there were Korean families. And across the stream that went right down the middle of Palolo Valley, there were Puerto Rican and Filipino families. So here were people from all over the world living together in one valley. But our teachers and our textbooks did not teach us why this diversity in Palolo Valley. So I grew up in Hawaii, and here I have a confession to make, Kara. I might look like a professor or even a philosopher with my silver mane, huh? But when I was a teenager, I was not academically inclined. In fact, I used to be a surfer. You know, I asked Kara, did you surf in Hawaii? I won't tell you what she told me. But I used to be a serious surfer. And I had a nickname. My nickname was Ten Toes Takaki. You know? Yeah. My dream was to be able to hang 10 on a surfboard. And when my students at Berkeley find out about Takaki's past, they get very curious. How did a surfer become a scholar? Well, what happened was this. I attended an Episcopalian high school. Kara, I attended Iolani High School. And during my senior year, I had to take a required course in religion. And my teacher's name was Dr. Sunji Nishi, PhD, a Japanese-American and Asian-American with a PhD. There were other Asian-American doctors in Hawaii, but they were all MDs. This one was a PhD. And all of his students were very impressed with Dr. Sunji Nishi, PhD. And I can remember, Kara, going home and asking my mother a question. My mother, who had only an eighth grade education, she'd been born on a sugarcane plantation. And I asked my mother a question. I said, Mom, my teacher's name is Dr. Sunji Nishi, PhD. Mom, what's a PhD? And she said, I don't know, but he must be very smart. You know? And I think a light went on in my head. Maybe someday I could become Ronald Takaki, PhD. Dr. Nishi required his students to read a book, and some of you here may be familiar with this book. It's entitled The Screwtape Letters, written by C.S. Lewis. These are letters written by the chief devil, Screwtape, to his nephew Wormwood on Earth, giving Wormwood instructions on how to entice and trap Christians into committing sin. So this were letters about the condition of society and the world. Give you an example. A letter to his nephew would say, teach Christians that the ends justify the means. So if the ends is democracy, then the means, war is moral, war is Christian. So Dr. Nishi required us to read a letter a week, and then the following week to write a letter. Writing was very important to Dr. Nishi. He gave us these written assignments, writing assignments. For Dr. Nishi, to write was to think, to increase one's awareness. So here, with Dr. Nishi as my role model, I began studying very hard and began to write these essays for Dr. Nishi. And Dr. Nishi wrote extensive marginal comments. And many of his marginal comments were epistemological questions. Do you know epistemology? It's a big 50-cent word that I teach all of my Berkeley students. Let me write it down for you. Can you read that? Yes. Hey, would anybody like to offer us a definition of epistemology? Who would like to offer a definition of epistemology? What's the meaning of epistemology? Yeah.
It's the theory of knowledge and the ways in which we know what we know and how we know what we know.
Hey, you get an A. Did everybody hear that? It's a theory of knowledge about how we know what we know, okay? How do we know it? Let me rephrase your answer, okay? I'll give everybody a brief working definition. This is what I teach my Berkeley students. Epistemology is a theory of knowledge, you're right. It's also a critical thinking skill. It's a way to think critically about the world. Epistemology asks the question, how do you know what you know? Okay, how do you know what you know? It's a question about your methodology, your approach to knowledge. So Dr. Nishi would write these epistemological questions in the margins of my essays. Well, a relationship then developed between me and Dr. Nishi. He began to mentor me. And during the second semester of my senior year, and this was late, this was around April, I had already been admitted to the University of Hawaii. As I was walking across campus, Dr. Nishi flagged me. He said, Ronald, wait a minute. I have a question I'd like to ask you. He said, Ronald, I think it would be good for you to go away to college. Good for your personal growth and for your intellectual development. There's this fine liberal arts college in Ohio called the College of Worcester. W-O-O-S-T-E-R. Would you like to go to the College of Worcester? And I blurted out, no. Kara, Ohio, you know, wow, it was so far away and had never been off the island. So I said, no. And he said, well, would it be okay if I wrote to the college to tell them about you? And I said, okay. And I walked away and I forgot completely about this conversation. Well, a month later, I received a letter from the dean of the College of Worcester, and the letter read, Dear Mr. Takaki, you have been accepted to the College of Worcester, but please fill out the application form. So on the basis of this one letter written by Dr. Nishi, I went to Worcester. And when I arrived there, this is in 1957. I experienced a culture shock. Yes. I discovered a very homogeneous student body. There were about 1,000 students there. And there were only 2 Asian American students. And I can remember early in that first fall semester, my fellow students asking me questions like, how long have you been in this country? Where did you learn to speak English? Asian American students today tell me they still get asked those questions. An underlying assumption of those questions is that we don't look American. I don't look like an American, and I do not have an American sounding name. At that time, when I was at Worcester, I didn't think too much about this. But now when I look back at my Worcester experience, I realize, I can see, that it was not their fault that they could not and did not see me as a fellow American. Think about it. What had they learned, say, in courses called United States History, about Asian Americans, or about Chicanos, or the native peoples of this country, or African Americans? There is what can be called the master narrative of American history. And we're all familiar with this master narrative. It's the powerful, pervasive, but mistaken story that this country was settled by European immigrants and that Americans are white or European in ancestry. And this master narrative is in the air. We don't even think about it. Let me give you an example. I can remember many years ago, President Ronald Reagan gave a speech to promote funding for the space program. And he declared, with Reagan's charisma, he declared, "We landed on these eastern shores, and we advanced the frontier westward, and space is America's latest frontier." Well, many of us watching Reagan on television asked the question, who we, you know? Many of us as indigenous people were already here in America when the Europeans arrived on these eastern shores. And many of us as Asian immigrants landed on these western shores and were all Americans. What happened to me at Worcester happened over 40 years ago. And today, educators, including educators here at Carleton, recognize the need for a more multicultural curriculum, a more inclusive curriculum. And this need is an intellectual need. It reaches toward a more accurate understanding of who we are and have been as Americans. But educators, even here at Carleton, are asking themselves a practical question. And the question is this: how do we do it? How do we teach students why so many different peoples from all over the world have come together in this valley called the United States of America? And here I'd like to identify three approaches. The first approach is the add-on approach. In other words, the course adds on materials for the study of minorities. So you'll have a day here on African Americans and maybe another day here on Chicanos. This add-on approach keeps intact the master narrative. It marginalizes minorities. A second approach is the group-specific approach, where a course studies one group, say Asian Americans or Native Americans. But this group-specific approach does not lead us to an understanding of diversity and also the big picture. There's a third approach, and this is the approach that I'd like us to consider this morning. This third approach is the comparative approach. This third approach studies different groups comparatively, analyzing the ways different experiences crisscrossed one another in American history. This comparative approach enables us not only to learn about a particular group, but also about one another. Now, I know Carleton has a requirement called the RAD requirement. Think about this third approach, this comparative approach. It would be one way to give recognition and affirmation of difference. But let me say this about the RAD requirement. To recognize and affirm difference require us to think critically about difference, to discern difference in relationship to power and domination, and to see how difference can lead to separatist nationalisms. Here we have this comparative approach that offers hope. The comparative approach to the study of racial and ethnic differences can affirm how we, as different peoples in America, belong to one nation. I can see it on some of your faces. You're saying, Professor Takaki, we find your comparative approach interesting, intriguing. But what does this approach look like concretely? You know, students love examples, okay? At this point, I'd like to give all of you a concrete example of how I do the third approach, the comparative approach. I'd like to be a historian, and I'd like to give you a 15-minute lecture within a lecture, a history lecture, okay? And I'd like this lecture to be interactive. I'd like to be able to ask you questions and for you to give me some answers. And then together, we will analyze history. And, hey, I said history, and I see it on some of your faces. History is usually his story, right? What about her story? So for this 15-minute lecture within a lecture, I'd like to look at it from the perspective of the women. I'd like to analyze her story. I'd like us to focus on the 19th century. The 19th century was the crucible for the making of modern multicultural America. And I'd like to examine two migrations, one across the Atlantic and another across the Pacific. Okay, so what group crossed the Atlantic in the 19th century in large numbers? And maybe some of you are in this room because of this migration. What group crossed the Atlantic? The Irish, okay. I'm going to write your answers here on the board. Okay, how many Irish came over here? Hey, it's not your fault, huh? You know, what did you learn about the Irish in courses called U.S. history, huh? Okay, I'm going to have to tell you then. 4 million. But I didn't know it myself until I started doing research. That's one reason why we do research. Okay, 4 million Irish came over here in the 19th century. What group crossed the Pacific in the 19th century? The Chinese, okay. How many Chinese came over here? This may be a tough question in Minnesota. But think about it. Still, this is American history. Okay? 500,000 came over here. Okay, now, from the perspective of the women, what percentage of the Irish immigrants were women? Just give a guess, okay? Who would like to guess a number? Yeah.
Less than 50%.
Wow, that's kind of vague, huh? Yeah. That's okay. It's not your fault. But this is what I learned. It was 52%. That's a high number, I thought. Because when you compare it with the Greek migration was only 3%. And the Italian migration was only 15%. So large number of Irish women came over here. What about the Chinese migrants? What percentage of the Chinese immigrants were women? Five. Who said five? You get an A+. Yes. 5%. Okay, this leads us then to an analytical question. Why is it that so many of the Irish immigrants were women? And why is it that so few of the Chinese immigrants were women? Okay? So we begin with the Irish migration. The Irish came over here because of the what? Potato famine. If you said potato famine, you're largely wrong, okay? Yeah. But here, you know, we can blame British imperialism, okay? There's a master narrative of British history. The blight caused it, not British imperialism, okay? During the potato famine, which lasted from 1854 to 1864, oh, excuse me, 1844 to 1854, 1 million Irish fled the deadly shores of Ireland, but 1 million came before the potato famine, and another 1 million came after the potato famine. So it couldn't have been just the potato famine. And even though I'm an American historian, I found myself reading deeply into Irish history. And this is what I learned. I learned that around 1800, British colonial policymakers in London came up with a policy for Ireland. They decided that Ireland should become the supplier of beef to England. So they sent instructions to British Protestant landlords in Ireland to transform agriculture in Ireland from tillage agriculture, potato agriculture, to ranching agriculture, okay? The commercialization of agriculture in Ireland from tillage to ranching. So a tremendous economic transformation occurred in Ireland in the early 19th century. And this economic transformation had gender significance. Think about it. In a tillage economy, women participated in the planting and harvesting of potatoes. In a ranching economy, women had been rendered economically superfluous. I wrote that down because I want you to also connect the dots to what is happening today. You know, what populations in the U.S. today are finding themselves rendered economically superfluous? Not just unemployed, but there are no jobs for them, okay? So this is what happened to these Irish women. There were no jobs for them. The men had been hired as wage earners, but the women felt pressures of push to cross the Atlantic in search of jobs. What did these Irish women do when they came over here? Well, a majority of them became maids, and that's why you have the stereotype of the Irish maid. But one third of them became factory workers. They worked in the factories, the textile mills of Lowell, Boston, Providence, Pawtucket, okay? And here, I'm going to draw a map of the United States. And I'd like you to use your imagination and also to be generous, okay? Because this is going to be a spontaneous map, spontaneously drawn map, okay? Oh, wait a minute. Michigan is too close there. Hey, let me try another one. Okay, that's a little better. Not bad. Yeah. Where's Carlton? Around here someplace. Huh? Okay, just imagine. Hey, Matt, use your imagination. Carlton is there. Okay. So here you have Lowell, Boston, Providence, Pawtucket, and you have these Irish women that are coming over here to work in these textile mills. Now, when I said textile mills, what came into your mind about what raw material were they processing? Cotton. Where did this cotton come from? Came from the South. Okay. Remember during the Watergate controversy, there was Deep Throat. Deep Throat said, follow the money. Well, for our 15-minute lecture within a lecture, I'd like us to follow the cotton. The cotton will unshroud the history of the making of our diversity. Okay, so we'll follow the cotton. It came from the South. Okay. Now, the industrializing of America occurred especially in New England, and cotton textile production was at the heart of the industrializing economy. This created a tremendous demand for cotton. So cotton agriculture expanded, advanced into the upcountry of Georgia and South Carolina, and then into Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, and Texas. These had been lands that had been inhabited by Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws. So entire tribes were uprooted, and they were forced to be relocated in Oklahoma. Okay? And these lands then became cotton lands. Cotton planted and picked by enslaved African Americans. I said cotton agriculture advanced into Texas. Texas at that time was part of what country? Mexico. So Americans were crossing the border into Mexico in Texas, and they were taking with them cotton seeds and enslaved African Americans. Mexico in 1830 declared that immigration from the United States is illegal. Americans continued to cross that border. Think about it. They were illegal aliens in Mexico. Mexico in 1830 also declared slavery illegal on Mexican territory. So what did these slaveholders do? Well, some of them barricaded themselves in a mission called the Alamo, and they seceded from Mexico. And the United States then annexed Texas. That led to the war against Mexico, 1846. If you were around at that time, 1846, reading the newspapers, this is what you would learn, what you would have learned about why the United States declared war against Mexico. There was this disputed territory, whether or not the border would be the Nueces River or the Rio Grande River. And James K. Polk, president, sent U.S. troops into this disputed territory. And allegedly, U.S. troops were attacked. And so James K. Polk then took a declaration of war to Congress. And the United States made war against Mexico. At the conclusion of the war, 2 years later, the United States acquired half of Mexico, including all of California. Historians now have access to the papers of the James K. Polk administration, and we know for a fact that political and business interests actually wanted a war against Mexico. Why? Because they wanted California, especially the Bay of San Francisco. The whaling industry was an important industry in the American economy. Whaling industry needed the San Francisco harbor, a port. Also, U.S. business interests wanted to develop trade with China. So, here the United States expanded all the way to the West Coast. This is San Francisco here. And this brings us to the second question, Chinese migration to America, and why so few of them were women. Well, the Chinese were pulled here because of jobs, okay? They worked on the Central Pacific Railroad. This is the railroad that was being built from California eastward. The Central Pacific Railroad had a workforce that was 90% Chinese. So here you have the Chinese men then building this railroad eastward. And then the Union Pacific was being built westward. And the Union Pacific had a workforce that was largely Irish. So when the two workforces met in Promontory Point, Utah, in 1869, they connected by this ribbon of steel, the East Coast and the West Coast. The Transcontinental Railroad was the achievement of immigrant workers from two different shores. But why is it that so few of these Chinese immigrants were women? Well, there were many reasons, and I won't go into all of them. You'll just have to read my book, okay? But I want to highlight one of them. These employers of Chinese laborers wanted men only. They did not want these men to come over here and bring women and children with them and have families in the United States. Charles Crocker, superintendent of the Central Pacific Railroad, said this in testimony before Congress. He said, "We want these men to come over here from China, work 3 to 5 years, and then we want them to return to China. We do not want them staying in America, raising families, and becoming," and he used this term, "thick." Thick in America. Here you have this master narrative of American history revealing itself in business policy. So, here we have it, our 15-minute lecture within a lecture. And we can see, we can discern that the Irish and the Chinese experiences were different, but they were connected to one another. And they were also connected to what happened to Cherokees, Choctaws, Chickasaws, to African Americans, and to Mexicans. Now I'd like to bring my larger lecture to closure. Now, so often, the study of difference actually leaves out the people of difference. This is especially true in what's called cultural studies, which analyzes, examines difference in terms of representations. But the people who are different are usually left out of this kind of study, this kind of approach, this kind of epistemology. But these people of difference are entitled to be studied as people with minds, wills, and voices. And I'd like to end my lecture today by sharing with you some of their voices. I told you about these Irish immigrant women working in the textile mills of Lowell. As they worked, they sang work songs. And historians have been gathering these work songs called the Songs of the Lowell Factory Girls. And I'd like to share with you one of these songs this morning. Okay, I'm not going to sing, yes. But I'd like you to listen between the lines. You know, I teach my students at Berkeley how critical thinking requires us to listen between the lines. What does it mean to listen between the lines? That is to get beneath the surface, to tease out the larger meaning of what you are hearing or what you are reading. To connect the dots between what you hear and what else you know. Okay, so as I share these voices with you, I'd like you to listen between the lines. The first is a song sung by these factory women. The song goes this way. "When I set out for Lowell, some factory for to find, I left my native country and all my friends behind. But now I am in Lowell, and summoned by the bell, I think less of my factory than of my native dell." What did you hear between the lines there in that one stanza. You might have heard that time has been redefined. It's no longer the movement of the sun as it would be in Ireland, but it's the bell. The bell. And what is this factory bell? Well, the third stanza says, "The factory bell begins to ring, and we must all obey, and to our old employment go, or else be turned away." This factory bell has become a mechanism for disciplining and punishing this immigrant workforce. Be there on time when that bell rings, or you will be fired. Okay? But these women also possessed a spirit of resistance. The last stanza goes, "Come all ye weary factory girls, I'll have you understand, I'm going to leave the factory and return to my native land." Well, very few of them returned. They stayed, they had families here, and they made America a more diverse society in terms of our religions. It was no longer a Protestant America. Well, what about the Chinese women? I had trouble finding the voices of the Chinese women. But as I did research, I came across a slender stack of copies of Western Union telegrams the Chinese men were sending to one another from the small towns in the foothills of the Sierras to San Francisco. And these telegrams were telegrams sent in English. So you can imagine a Chinese man walking into a Western Union office, the message would be translated from Chinese into English and would be sent sizzling over the wire. Now, the telegram was state-of-the-art electronic communication at that time. It's like email today, okay? So here we have a chance to listen in to what these Chinese men were saying to one another. And you're probably wondering, Professor Takaki, what did these Chinese men say to one another? Well, I can remember coming across one telegram. It was a short telegram. It had one line only. And the one line read something like this: "Send the opium up quick." Okay. Now, I ask my students at Berkeley, if you listen between the lines, what can you hear? And some of them will raise their hands. "Well, Professor Takaki, they're up in the foothills of the Sierras. Work up there must have been punishing. They're also men without their families. They're lonely. So they needed the opium to help them escape, okay? But then there are other students who would ask themselves the epistemological question, you know, how do you know what you know about opium? Why opium? And then there would be that light, the British Opium Wars, the Treaty of Nanking, 1842. In the 19th century, the first half of the 19th century, England had a trade imbalance with China. We all know about trade imbalances today. England was importing porcelain, silk, tea from China, but it didn't have a product to export to China. So these British colonial policymakers who were making policies for Ireland were also making policies for China. They decided to ship opium from India to China and to make a profit. They were drug dealers when you think about it, huh? The Chinese government said, "You may not ship opium to China," and that opened the way to the British Opium Wars. And at the end of the British Opium Wars, England annexed Hong Kong. The migration to California came largely from southern China, where the British Opium Wars occurred. So they were fleeing from the turmoil of war. And many of these Chinese immigrants had already been addicted to opium before they even arrived here. Okay. As I was going through these telegrams, and I'm going through them chronologically, I came across a number of references to this man named Phuc Sinh. He was living in Downeyville, California. So imagine the geography of California. Here you have San Francisco, Sacramento, inland, about 100 miles. Marysville, above Sacramento, by about 25 miles. And then Downeyville, about 70 miles east of Marysville. And then on you have the state line, and on the other side of the state line, you have Nevada. And in Nevada, you have this small town called Wadsworth. Well, Fuk Singh was living in Downeyville, California, and he had been told about this Chinese immigrant woman, one of the 5%, named Min Q, living in Wadsworth, Nevada. So Fuk Singh gets all excited. He wants to meet and marry Min Q. You know, you'd get excited too, huh? If 75% of you were men, okay? Now, Fuk Singh has this friend living in Wadsworth, Nevada. So he telegraphs his friend named Cao Chung. The telegram is dated July 25th, 1874. The telegram reads, "Don't you let her go, Min Q. Don't you let her go. I will come tomorrow and see her. I want to bring her to Downeyville to live with me. What time does the train start? Answer quick." You know, you'd be eager too, okay? So, but Fuk Singh went back to that Western Union office the next day. He sends another message to Chung. "I will start for Wadsworth today and meet her. Tell her to wait for me to come." And then he says, there was another man. He says, "And if she wants to go with the other man, I will let her. Don't care." But he does care because he says, "Answer quick." But this Min Q went off, or she was taken away by this other man. So here I am, the historian, I think to myself, oh, I guess this is the end of this story. But then I come across this telegram dated August 12, 1874, about 3 weeks later, sent by Ah Tom to Tin Yui of Downeyville. The telegram reads, "Fuk Singh's woman has gone to Marysville." Wow, Min Q is in California. She's in Marysville. So what does Fuk Singh do? He goes back to that Western Union office. He has a friend in Marysville named Sing Lung. He wires him, "Bring woman up right away. We'll pay $300. Hey, that's a lot of money in those days. Answer. But then he thought, what about the other man? So he adds this line, "Is man who took woman there? Answer." Well, at 11.05 a.m. the same day, you know, these telegrams are going back and forth furiously now. At 11.05 a.m. the same day, Sing Lung wires Tai Yung in Downeyville. Telegram reads, "Fuk Singh's woman, tell Fuk Singh, Min Q is here. What you going to do? Answer, quick." So Fuk Singh had found the woman, but the question is, well, would Min Q be willing to leave the man she's with and to be with Fuk Singh? Well, at 4:20 p.m. the same day, the answer comes sizzling over the wire. Sing Lung telegraphs Fuk Singh. The telegram reads, "She wants you to come right away and get warrant with officer." You see, they're going to have to take away from the other man. "Get warrant with officer. Friends will help. You don't be afraid. We will get her sure." So Fuk Singh rushes in a stagecoach to Marysville, and the next day he wires his friend, still back in Downeyville, Tai Yuan. His telegram reads, "I saw the woman, but have not yet taken her. Send marriage certificate." And his friend wires back, "We'll send the certificate next stage." Okay. Now, what did you hear listening between the lines? You would have heard at least two things, and maybe even more. One, you would have heard the silence of Min Q, right? These are men talking to one another. But even within that silence, you would have heard Min Q breaking that silence. The men had to ask her, you know, "Who will be your partner in life?" Okay, she insisted on making a choice. Had she been in China, her parents would have arranged her marriage. In America, she decided that she wanted to make a decision about her future. Also, when you listen between the lines, you ask the question, well, who was Min Q? You know, this is all the evidence we have about her. And what dots can we connect? How can we get beneath the surface? Well, what we do at Berkeley is that we look at the context of Min Q. One way to look at that context context is to look at the census of 1870 for California. The census reveals that 70% of the Chinese women in California listed as their occupation prostitution. Okay. So here you have, you know, business leaders bringing Chinese men but keeping Chinese women out, creating problems of prostitution. Okay. Min Q may have been one of those Chinese prostitutes. This was 1870. These telegrams were dated 1874. So here you have Chinese women forced to come over here and to serve as sexual indentured servants to work off the cost of their transportation, 3 to 5 years. Min Q may have been one of those prostitutes. She had worked off her indenture, and now she was a free woman. But what about Phuc Sinh? Who was Phuc Sinh? Well, we don't know who he was. But the date tells us something. 1874. When was the Transcontinental Railroad completed? 18 what? I just told you. You forgot already? That's all right. It happens, you know. Yeah, I understand that we're going to forget 80% of what we've learned in college. 1869. Okay, it's 5 years later. Phuc Sinh still hasn't returned to China. Notice what is happening here. Phuc Sinh had made a decision, you know. And his decision reveals the making of multicultural America, because other immigrants would be making decisions too. Phuc Sinh had decided that maybe I don't want to go back to China. Maybe I want to stay in America. Maybe I want to make America my home. Maybe I'd like to become a Chinese American. And Phuc Sinh was sending a message to the master narrative of American history. He was challenging that master narrative. He was saying, hey, wait a minute. I'm an American too. I came here. I helped to build this economy. I transformed America, and in the process, I transformed myself. And American history should include me and other Chinese who landed on these Western shores. In the footsteps of Phuc Sinh would come others. My grandfather from Japan. Others would come from Korea, the Philippines, India, Pakistan, Mexico, Italy, Hungary, Poland, Russia. Others would be forced to come here from Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia. And if you listen to all of these people, right here, even in Minnesota, in the small towns where you have Hormel meatpacking plants, in St. Paul, you can hear them saying, maybe, maybe, maybe I'd like to make America my home. Maybe I'd like to become an American. But to hear them, we first have to become listeners. And this is where I'd like to end my lecture today. I'd like to end by thanking you, because you've been great listeners, interactive listeners, even willing to give me wrong answers. But that's okay. You know, it's better to get wrong answers, to give wrong answers, because how do you learn otherwise, okay? And I'd like to end then by thanking you for being good listeners. Thank you for listening to the song of the Irish immigrant women. Thank you for listening to the silence of Min Q. Thank you for listening to the maybes of Phuc Sinh. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you. I'd like to engage you in Q&A for a few minutes, 5 minutes. Would anybody like to ask a question and just stand up and raise your hand? I love Q&A moments. So who'd like to begin? Oh, right here. Okay. Where? Oh, over there. UCLA. Hey, UCLA. Yes.
Happens to speak of this trip today. Yes, as you know, more immigrants from Asia are coming into the United States and, you know, raising families here. I'm wondering, in the process of, Asian American being recognized in the U.S. Society, what are the, maybe the basic features that you see in all the, former Asian Americans that have been successful or have been able to be recognized by society?
Okay. It's a complicated question. He said, here in America, Asians become Asian Americans. And how did this happen? But how did they make it happen to become Asian Americans? Okay. Well,
how did they become recognized?
How did they what?
How did they become recognized?
How did they become recognized as Asian American?
Or even as, accepted as one of the crucial makeup of the society.
Okay. How do they become part of America?
Yeah.
How do they become? Okay. One thing I learned in my research on my book, Strangers from a Different Shore, is that there are no Asians in Asia. There are Japanese, Chinese, Vietnamese, Cambodians, Indians. They don't think of themselves as Asians. We became Asians in America. What made us Asians in America? Well, it was not just our difference, but how our difference intersected with power and domination. Even many decades before the arrival of the first Chinese to these Western shores, the United States Congress in 1790 had passed a law called the Naturalization Act. And this law specified that in order to be eligible for naturalized citizenship, you first had to be white, and it used that term, white. Here you have the master narrative informing government policy. And you might think, Professor Takaki, that was 1790, a long time ago. Well, let me tell you that that law remained a federal law until 1952. And because of that law, my grandfather never became a citizen of the United States. So how do we become part of America? Well, we fight laws that exclude us, okay? We rescinded that Naturalization Act of 1790, 1952. And then we joined the Civil Rights Movement. We supported the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and that opened the way then to the Immigration Act of 1965 that reopened the gates to immigration from Asian countries. But we have to do more than that. We have to also recover this history and become scholars and rewrite American history to show that, yes, Asian Americans are a part of the history of the United States of America. But I'd like to see us also transform the entertainment media and the news media. I'd like to see an Asian male news anchor. What about that, huh? Yeah. Why only Asian American women, huh? Like Connie Chung, Yeah. What's wrong with the men, huh? Yeah. But also in the entertainment media. We have to be there also in the entertainment media. That's the way we become part of America. And I hope that many of the students who graduate from Carleton will go out there and make change. You have that RAD requirement. Huh? Make sure that those courses allow you not only to comprehend the world, but also to change the world. Thank you for your question. Yeah, maybe one more question. Okay. Wait, where? Stand up. Oh, wait, stand up. Yeah, stand up. Ask your question. Shout it.
I guess I wonder if becoming part of
part of America is universally considered as good. Because I'm in a class right now where we're discussing contemporary Native American issues. And we look at the ways in which Americanization is kind of, it's imposing hegemony of what American is on other cultures that don't necessarily fit that mold and shouldn't have to. So is Americanization something that should be desired, or is that a term that needs to be problematized and discussed?
Okay. Thank you for your question. You know about the metaphor of the melting pot, huh? You know, that means that immigrants come here and they melt in. They become Americanized, to use your term. The melting pot was a popular concept and also a program designed to melt in European immigrants, especially from Italy and Russia, to melt them in, to force them to change their names and give up their languages, okay, to become American, which meant to become Protestant and English. What's underway now in this study of difference is how we can create an America of differences, and it's okay to be different. It's okay to be ethnic. It's okay to have your own culture and your own identity. And that's what I'm trying to do in my teaching and in my scholarship. It's okay to be an indigenous person in this country and to maintain your identity and your ties to that culture. But still, I think that this is what it means then, you know, to be a people of differences in America. Still, the question is, well, what makes us one people then? Well, I think history can help us become one people, like to look at history so that we see how our experiences as members of different groups have crisscrossed one another. And that's why I tried to connect the stories of the Cherokees, Choctaws, and Chickasaws to the other stories, the Irish and the Chinese and the African American and the Mexican story. So history can be one way for us to find ties that bind. I also like to think about our founding principles as ties that bind. I'm thinking about the Declaration of Independence. You know, how here we have a document, our founding document, that says that it is a self-evident truth that we are equal and we're entitled to pursue life, liberty, happiness. So what does equality mean, you see, in a society where you have different peoples? I think equality means equality of differences. And this would include then differences of the indigenous people of the United States of America. Hey, that's a great way to end our lecture this morning, our morning session. You know, kind of an upbeat, hopeful vision. Thank you, thank you, thank you.